As promised, I am thrilled to announce that our tickets for Australian True Crime Live are now available. Join me in Sydney, Brisbane, and or Melbourne this July. You can come to all three if you want. These tickets are expected to go very quickly, so be sure to secure yours by visiting the link in our podcast bio, or you can head over to the Australian True Crime Facebook page. There'll be a nice link there for you. Update for Brisbane, Australian True Crime fans. Brisbane is almost fully sold out for our live show. If you've been a listener for any length of time, you'll know how passionate I am about true crime stories from Australia. I'm looking very forward to an incredible evening together with you, sharing these captivating tales. We will have great guests as well. So, you know, we love a Q&A. If you've ever come along to an Australian true crime live gig, you'll know we love a Q&A with our guests. Don't miss out. Book your tickets today, and I'll see you in July for a memorable night out.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems. But getting therapy has its own problems too. Like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable, too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
This is a true crime podcast, as the title suggests. So please consider this your warning that it's not suitable for children, and it probably will contain content that may be triggering to some people. Also, it's an Australian true crime podcast, so Australian Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners should be aware it may contain the voices of deceased people.
The producers of this podcast recognise the traditional owners of the land on which it's recorded. They pay respect to the Aboriginal elders past, present, and those emerging.
On the afternoon of the 13th of February 2017, teenagers Abby Williams and Libby German were dropped off at a popular hiking trail near the Monon High Bridge, just outside their hometown of Delphi, Indiana. About 40 minutes later, Libby posted a picture on her Snapchat account showing Abby carefully walking across the bridge. It was the last time they made contact with the outside world, although it wasn't the last time Libby recorded their surroundings. The girls were reported missing later that afternoon, and community members searched for them through the night, but sadly, their bodies were discovered nearby the following day. The day after that, police released a photograph of a man they wanted to speak to. It was grainy, but it was pretty close up. Surely, they thought, in this tight-knit community of less than 3,000 people, somebody would recognise the man in the picture. It would be another frustrating week without a break before police made the startling admission that the photo was actually a still image from a video. The video was recorded by one of the victims, Libby German. At that point, they also released a few seconds of the video with audio in which the man appeared to order the girls to move down the hill. The video turned the case into an international sensation, and yet, years passed without an arrest. Until finally, in October 2022, a local man was taken into custody. Who is he? Did he know the girls? Is there any truth to the rumours that other people may yet be charged? The best person to ask these questions is without a doubt journalist Susan Hendricks. She's been following the case since she first read the headline about two missing girls as a news anchor in 2017. She's followed it all the way through. She's become close to the families and investigators. And last year, Susan released the book Down the Hill, which tells the whole story. She joins us in this special episode of ATC Plus for subscribers only to talk about it.
It was February 13th, 2017, when the girls were reported missing. And I remember being on the set that day, and we did cover it as two girls missing, but nothing had come about, meaning they didn't know, of course, the severity. And at first we didn't cover it because no one knew about it. It was the families thinking, okay, Libby's dad, Derek, was supposed to meet them at the trailhead at 3 o'clock. They never showed up. He called Becky, his mom, and said, the girls aren't here. What do I do? He started calling their names. So of course, at that particular point, you never think that the worst would occur. Your mind just doesn't go there. But as the hours went on and the girls weren't around, weren't coming home, weren't calling, and Libby, of course, had her cell phone, they started to worry and get concerned. But their thought process was, oh, maybe they just got injured. They can't move. Maybe someone broke a leg. Kelsey, Libby's sister, told me that her mind was going everywhere. But then the town, such a small town, under 3,000 people, really rallied around this, got together and formed this search party. And they were searching with officials as well. As soon as they were reported missing, I say the search kind of picked up steam around 5:15, a little bit later, when they were officially declared missing. And the authorities called off the search officially. And Sheriff Tope Lesenby said, look, it's so dense down there and it became dangerous. So officially they called it off, but no one really left in terms of the townspeople of Delphi. They were down there with their flashlights. And Becky remembers just that orange glow, that yellow-orange glow of the lights of the flashlights, and feeling good that, okay, everyone's down here, everyone's looking, and they all were positive at that point. But it was cold that night. It was abnormally warm during the day than it normally is. But at night, of course, the temperatures were dropping, and that's when the worry set in. But their minds had never gone to murder at that particular point. Next morning, everyone gets up, starts again. And it's not like they went home and went to bed. I mean, there were people looking throughout the night. And the next day, when the sun came up, I believe was around 12 noon their time. And again, it is dense down there. So if you've never seen the area, you may think, well, how could no one have spotted the girls? Well, it's because of all the brush and the small hills and the creek down there. But Becky said she held on to hope that morning, even so. And then she heard a firefighter say that they had found the girls. She heard whispers of that. And she got her hopes up and went up to her sister and said, they found them, they found them. And her sister knew at that point. And then she said she saw her sister's face and then knew it was the worst outcome that they could even imagine. And they couldn't really grasp it at that particular point.
No, because it is such a small community. It's a safe community, right? It was unfathomable that the girls could have been taken by somebody, murdered, let alone as the story progressed, it became such a horrifying story, more and more so. It's the kind of community as well where if there were blow-ins, we would call them in Australia, people who are tourists, people who were new to town, they would have noticed.
Right, exactly. Because it was so small, less than 3,000 people in the entire town. So if you didn't know someone by name, you may have known their family member. And it just felt to me like this perfect small town when I went there in 2019. But the next day on the set, I do remember it was breaking news. I was anchoring and it came in that the girls' bodies were discovered. So the producer said in my ear, "We're getting an interview with you, Ron Logan. He owns the property. He's coming up after next commercial break." I said, okay. So then we're in the commercial break. I do a mic check and I know that it's his land where the bodies were discovered. And we have about a minute or two in between to kind of gather that information, and then so be it, we're live. And he says, "This is horrible. I would never imagine that it would happen here. This could have happened to my boys," saying that his boys were raised there. They went down there all the time to the bridge. What surprised me, it was more difficult to get to, because when you see the bridge and you see the man, the video that Libby was able to record on her phone walking, you think maybe, at least I did, you don't see the enormity of this.
You make that point so well in the book. You're so right. When we're seeing her photos and even media photos, absolutely, we underestimate, I think, the area, the topography, and certainly the bridge. But you go into a lot of detail in the book about this area and the bridge itself. It is a very, very dangerous spot. And I guess locals have become sort of, you know, very relaxed about it. But yeah, tell us about the first time you saw, this location.
It was February 2019, and it was almost 2 years to the day that the girls were murdered. And I went there to cover the story. A producer said, "We're sending you to Delphi." And I had interviewed Sheriff Tobe Lesenby, a detective, Becky Patty. I had gotten to know Mike Patty. I was in their living room, and Kelsey. Becky and Mike are Libby's grandparents, who she lived with. And so I got to know them and I became closest to them, because Abby's family had chosen, and Mike and their family, Libby's family, respected that just differently, how to deal with the media. Because everyone, you never think, what would I do? And you don't think you're going to be in that situation. They're more of a private family. And I remember before I met Mike, he stood up at the podium, I believe it was in early March, reading a statement from Abby's family saying they chose to be more private at this particular time. And to please respect that, he was speaking to the media. So it had been almost a month or less than since the girls had been murdered when he said that. But when I said to Kelsey, Libby's sister, that that's where we were going next, it was two photojournalists from CNN, myself and a producer. And Kelsey said, "I'll go with you." And Mike, I remember looking over and he said, "Are you sure? Are you okay?" Because if you think about the bridge and the memories, and Kelsey was the last one to see them, she dropped them off. So she said, "No, I'm okay." So I remember walking down with Kelsey, and it was pretty cold that day, but we had hand warmers. We were ready, boot warmers. And I was joking about how freezing it was. And she was just so kind and very young, only 19 at the time, 18 when her sister was murdered.
But very, very mature, isn't she? She was already working.
Yeah.
A salt of the earth kind of family.
Yes. And very mature in certain ways, but also very young in other ways. So you realize, oh, she was only 18 at the time. And look, she was thrust into that position of being an advocate for her sister, not to mention all the guilt that she told me she felt on the inside. So as we approached, I went, you walk up to it. It took about 15 minutes to get there, maybe 10, 15 minutes during the walk, but we did stop for a short time on the way there. And the CNN photojournalist said, "Hey, we're not allowed to get arrested anymore. You know, we're going to get a lot of trouble. We're calling CNN," because it said no trespassing. But Kelsey said, "No, it's fine," because they're used to that area and saying those signs are always there. And he said, we'll wait back and we'll call." And Kelsey was talking to Barbara, my producer at the time, and I just thought, oh, I'll walk up a little bit. Maybe I'll see it. And I started to walk a couple feet, and then it felt very isolating. It really did. I understood, okay, I could see this, because we reported so many times, as different media outlets were, that how could this happen in the middle of the day?
Mm.
Well, it's dense, and no one was there when I was there, but it's not what you would picture. Oh, kids go there all the time. You could see how there's little pockets of hidden areas and how Of course, I knew why I was there, the double murder. So it may have been a preconceived notion I had, but it just felt chilling. So I paused and said, I'm not walking anywhere near this bridge alone. I ran back, then we all go, and I see it. And I thought, oh my gosh, I mean, that massive. It was 63 feet up. I didn't know at the time, you could have told me 100. But what was most chilling were the big gaps in between. It was an abandoned railroad. So just, I mean, gaps. And I'm scared of heights as a young kid, I guess, Abby and Libby's age. I wouldn't have been. I could see myself walking across there when you have no fear. And it's kind of what you do.
We get a little bit of a sense of that in the photo of Abby, where she's obviously sort of, she's looking down. She's being quite cautious as she's taking a big step across. But you're right, in the video though of the man walking towards them, he appears to be walking very, very confidently. I don't feel as though there's any gaps beneath his feet at all.
That's a great point that you bring up about Abby, because she had never been there, maybe not never, but not often, according to her family. Well, Libby had been there a lot. So to Libby, she was used to walking across it. It was no big deal. That's exactly what I saw with the man on the bridge. To him, you would have thought that it was just a sidewalk, that he was taking a stroll. So it was clear to me that that person had been there, especially once I saw the bridge. And I went, oh my gosh. And I did mention Paul Holes earlier. He said that to me too, that when he didn't understand, he saw pictures, but he didn't understand certain things about the crime and just what, I mean, that's what he does. And he's excellent at it, obviously. So he can see things and assess things and maybe put his mind in a killer's mind and look around and see, he said to me in the chapter, I see things that don't have to be there. Meaning the crime didn't have to, this didn't have to be part of this. And why was it there? His question was, why down the hill? Why that particular area? When there's houses, there's a few in the background. And then he understood once he saw it, how isolating it was. And he essentially said to me at the end of that bridge, at the end, and maybe Richard Allen was lying in wait, innocent until proven guilty, but he was charged. Maybe he waited for that. And that was the trap. That is what his plan entailed, was to get the girls on the other side of the bridge, take them down the hill, knowing that he would have time to do what he wanted to do.
So were they kind of trapped at the end of that bridge? There was no, yeah, that's the sense I get. They couldn't run, for example, by that stage, right? Because they could see him coming for quite a ways. And clearly Libby, if not Abby, or maybe both, she got a bad feeling. She got a bad feeling for quite a while when he was approaching them because she started recording.
Oh, she did. And Becky said to me, you know, Susan, she watched those crime shows. Wanted to study, be in that field in some way. She would talk about it. So I think, and Mike said to me, you know what, Susan, I think that she wanted to come home. The reason she hit record and say, Grandpa, look at this guy. Isn't he creepy on the bridge? Because your mind doesn't go, especially as a 14-year-old. Or really, I mean, you may get a sense, and I believe fully that they both sensed, of course, something was off. But to hit record, you don't think this person can murder the both of us. The reason why it was a trap is that now is private property. And that is where, because the entryway on the other side is where they were dropped off. So the chances of seeing other people, and that's where witnesses, according to the probable cause affidavit, saw someone they thought looked like Richard Allen. But on this side, it's a lot more isolating. I mean, it essentially, yes, it is a trap, because where are you going to go? It's private property. The homes are too far. On the recording on Libby's phone, we now hear in the court documents, we now see that he did have a gun, and Abby said, is that a gun? So of course, two young girls, it's been a question from some who ask, well, how do you think this person, a rhetorical question, controlled two girls? Well, I could see that if I was 13 or 14, anyone has a gun, I'm going to listen to them.
Yeah, absolutely. So I didn't realize that more of the, at least the audio from that video had been released now.
Not released so where you and I could hear it, but released in terms of there was a gun mentioned. So it said, it's a gun. And then of course the unspent bullet, which was found in between the girls' bodies, was matched. And I had to learn a lot about the bullets and what you can see and can't see and what an unspent bullet even is. But apparently, and it's, as you know, if you've covered any trials, I'm sure you have, it can end up being a battle of the experts. If we see that, we see that in many trials. So according to one expert, they may say, look, this is like a fingerprint. This bullet nails the person if we connect it to the gun. Another person may get up there and say it's junk science, can't prove it. So we'll see what happens there. But it was enough. And it was redacted part of the probable cause affidavit. So we don't know exactly the other evidence. We just don't know it at this time. We do know the unspent bullet, but I wonder what finally led to the arrest of Richard Allen. Was it a tip? Was it a call from maybe the daughter's husband? I'm purely speculating here, but I'm thinking what finally led to that? Or was it what the superintendent said all along? If we don't find anything, we'll go back to the beginning. And is that where they found his name, at the beginning?
At the beginning of all the tips of all the, because they did interview him, didn't they? Very, very early
yes,
on, they did speak to him.
Exactly. That's the beginning, right? When he came forward, which it's frustrating and infuriating all at once for the families because he put himself there, which is interesting to me because the recording at first what was released from Libby's phone was a still shot. And then they came out with the sketch. And then later, of course, the video. But down the hill, the voice we did, Guys Down the Hill, came later, April 2019. The word guys was added to Down the Hill. But that was not released to the media at that time when he came forward and said, I was there. This was with a conservation officer meeting him in some sort of parking lot saying, I was there. This is what I was wearing. I was looking at my phone at the stock ticker and I was watching fish, looking at fish, which seemed odd, but put himself there that particular time. Since then, he's kind of dialed back that time, or his attorneys have, meaning what time he put himself at the bridge. But would he have put himself there if his image was released in the media? I don't think so. And it does make me wonder if it turns out to be Richard Allen. Is that the thing that convicted? What if he never came forward? So apparently the frustration is that that conservation officer took down the notes, said, thank you. I believe maybe he looked at this. Of course, nothing like this had ever happened in this town. He looked at this person working at CVS, husband, father, as more of a witness than a possible suspect.
Absolutely, because that's obviously how he was presenting himself. You know, in those early days when police say, if you were there, please come forward. You may have seen something. You may not realize you saw something, but please come forward. So no doubt that's how he was presenting himself as a potential witness who came forward and said, I'd love to help you. I didn't see anything, but I was there looking at fish. Very innocent, very innocuous. Yeah, I just work at the local pharmacy. I'm a local guy.
And I think, though, that the question that has been brought up even to me saying, but wait, if the video came out and the audio came out and you see the guy, wouldn't you say wait a minute, Richard Allen came to me. Is that him? That connection never happened. Of course, I'm not blaming by any means one particular person for this massive investigation where the FBI was involved. But I will say the Indiana State Police came out and said this was a misfiling, quote unquote, by the FBI. It was a mistake. It was filed in the wrong spot. I don't know, literal files. I think maybe on the computer is what they're saying, but somebody messed up. So they're saying the FBI misfiled. Well, the FBI came out right away with a statement and said it wasn't us. We didn't misfile anything. So you kind of see the cracks in the cohesiveness. And I wonder if the cracks were there all along.
It's very, very common story, don't you think? I mean, we certainly, you know, I'm sure you've heard of Ivan Milat, our backpacker killer here in Australia. There was a young British man who was kidnapped by Ivan Milat and taken to the spot, and they went through all the kind of MO, and he managed to escape. And he called in that attack to police years before Milat was captured, and it was misfiled. It was just lost.
It was just lost, right? Yeah. And so if there's one thing that may be missing, or if because the cohesiveness obviously wasn't there at that particular time, no blame on anyone in particular, because we still don't have all of the information, it does make you wonder, because the biggest fear for the families was, if this person is capable of this double murder, horrific murder, slaughtering two young girls, he's capable of doing it again.
Yeah.
That was the family's biggest fear.
Yeah, because that's a big attack, isn't it? You would think people don't usually start that way and they don't usually finish that way. It's not usually an attack that someone carries out once.
Right. And he was 44 years old in his 40s. I asked Paul that. I said, can it happen? Does it happen? Is it odd to you that it would happen? And he said, well, it is, because you think a father, a husband, you're going to wake up at 44 years old and kill two young girls in the middle of the day. He did mention, though, the fantasy of this, if he had been thinking about it for years and years and acting on this and then having that fantasy and having that sustain him, because there was no arrest for close to 6 years. But that was a fear for everyone in the community.
Yeah, absolutely. What about the idea that there was a, or that one of the girls at least was in touch, I think via Snapchat, with an account that was actually a group of men sharing an account and using it to contact girls, young girls?
Yeah, Keegan Klein, it came out through, and again, during the investigation, whether it was connected to the murders of Abby and Libby or not, there was really no information that was given to the media. It was trickling in and out. But the Indiana State Police, when they did come out and say, has anyone interacted with this handle? It was Anthony Schatz, aka Keegan Klein, they connected it to someone that looked nothing like Anthony Schatz. It turns out
Keegan Klein is the real man.
Right, the real person. And Anthony Schatz was a model, and they took modeling pictures, and now a police officer, and he has two daughters now. He came out and spoke to a local news outlet and said, I just feel horrible about this, that my picture was used, if it was connected to the murders. But what we do know is there was communication from Libby's phone to Anthony Schatz, not knowing, of course, because, and so that was it, thinking, could this be it? Because the Indiana State Police saying, look, we're not saying why we want to know, but if you have interacted with this handle who you thought was Anthony Schatz, come forward. And at that time, these, let's say there were young girls who were in contact with this, with Anthony Schatz, 5 years prior. So Kelsey posted on Twitter saying, if anyone interacted with this, please come forward. Investigators want to know that information. So it was clear they wouldn't say how or why that piqued their interest.
So the Anthony Schatz account was a classic catfishing account. That we know.
Yeah, that we know. So Becky was devastated, saying, I spoke to Libby. I feel like I failed her. In the beginning, it was called the Snapchat murders, because Libby did post that picture of Abby to Snapchat. But then that went away, kind of the thought, because everyone thought that in the beginning, could this be connected to something with social media at all in any way? And investigators telling the families, look, right now, no. But then when this name came up, Becky was thinking, did I fail her? Did I not talk to her enough? And we were on stage at CrimeCon, and Paul looked over and said, first of all, these predators are very good at what they do. They're very good at grooming. It's not your fault. These are 13, Abby and Libby were 13 and 14. Girls that age want to meet cute guys. He was cute. And they thought, oh, this is fun. And that, don't blame yourself. And of course, no one blames the young girls. Now, the big question was this connected to the murders? Well, with the lack of information that we had, and I understand the superintendent, Doug Carter, fielding questions for years, some of the same questions with media outlets everywhere saying, first of all, how did the sketches change? Why haven't you arrested someone? It's a small town, under 3,000 people. Cut that in half, let's say about 1,500 people. Why is there no movement here? And he took that and he said, we're working as hard as we can. We're working in unison with the FBI, Indiana State Police. I mean, doing what they can. And the families really had a good relationship with authorities as well, saying, we know how much they care. Abby's grandmother told me, you know, Susan, I saw their phone, one of the detectives, and the screensaver was Abby and Libby. They stay up at night. They sleepless nights. A couple of investigators put off retirement. So she said it wasn't a lack of caring. But if you think about it, and there was no connection, I've heard this from several people saying, if it is a murder where there is no connection, no, it's not your family initially, if there's no, those are very difficult to solve. So what I think they were banking on during this long, tedious investigation of tip after tip is someone recognizing the man on the bridge, saying, that's my dad, that's my uncle, that's my cousin. And that, I think, is where all of their resources at first went, like, oh, someone's got to come forward.
Because he did seem so recognizable, right? That was the frustration right. For years. This is a small community. And this video, while grainy, it seemed pretty distinctive. The walk, the body shape, the voice, it all seemed pretty distinctive.
Like so many people, I've watched that piece of video. It's a couple seconds over and over again. And because Libby was so far back, you can't make out any facial features. And I believe he had something covering here and maybe a hat. So it's hard to see, right? And you can zoom in, and I've listened to that over and over again. And then you wonder, is the jacket bulky? Is he thin? Is he heavier? Is he holding something in there? I mean, so many people were analyzing this and saying, who could it be? I will say that being in the town, so many men look like that. They just do. They all do.
Yeah,
they all do. They all have the blue jacket. They all have blue jeans. They all have the boots. It doesn't feel like out of place.
Okay.
So that's why I think unless you're there and you see it, that you say, oh, I understand why it's not solved.
I shouldn't chuckle, but when you say that, yeah, I think I look around in my own town and I think, yeah, there are men of a certain generation who do all dress and look the same. Absolutely. Because I remember seeing a photo after Richard Allen was arrested where he was wearing a jacket that looked very much like the jacket in the video. And people were saying, oh, well, there you go. It's the jacket. And now that you say that, I think, oh God, probably every man in town has that jacket.
Yeah, every man in town has a jacket and they're either older or younger, but they all look like that from what you could see, although it's blurry. And I even thought to myself, I wondered if that was a relative of mine, would I know? Would I know if he walked that way? Maybe the voice I would know with down the hill. And then when he said guys, it seemed more friendly. So it was so, I think that's why it did generate so much attention and garner so much attention. Number one, because he's that horrific crime and these innocent young girls having the wherewithal to record this. So we were able to hear the voice of a killer, which was chilling. And everyone, of course, that the family said, we need your help. Please call in a tip line. It seemed like there were so many people who wanted to get the guy in the bridge and it just wasn't happening year after year.
Were people calling in a lot of names though? Were people, you know, were police tied up for a long time? Yeah. Sifting through people who were not connected.
I was on stage with a panel with Sergeant Kim Riley, who was on this from the start. I mean, he was the one who was at the first press conference making the announcement saying two bodies were discovered. We suspect foul play. He has since retired and he was on stage and this was 2 years later. And he said, look, we want to give you some facts about what a good tip is. They literally had to spell it out because I think with good intentions, people would call in and say, I saw a guy in a Greyhound in Michigan. It looked like the guy. And that would be the tip. I mean, so what are they going to do with that? Or it's my cousin, Jim. He lives in Florida and that's it. So it's who you think it is. And that you could remain, of course, anonymous with this, but who you think it is, why, their name. And the families did say when they were pleading for help from the public, no tip is insignificant. So they also wanted you to recognize people in your own family. I believe once they saw the way he was walking, they knew who was from there because it's difficult to even find the bridge, much less be able to navigate that area and walk on the bridge like he was. So they thought he was in town. So saying, is someone, did they gain weight? Did they lose weight? Are they using drugs? Are they using alcohol? Are they acting? Has their behavior shifted after the murders? And I think they were really pleading with family members to say, look inside of your own house. Abby and Libby need you and the public needs you. One of the press conferences going as far as to say, this could happen again if you don't call in. Almost saying, we know someone recognizes this guy. Tell us it's him and let's get him. And that didn't happen.
One of the most incredible moments I've ever seen in my life at a press conference was when the lead detective started saying, you might be in this room.
I mean, that was chilling.
Directly to the killer who may be in this room. We believe you are hiding in plain sight. For more than 2 years, you never thought we would shift gears to a different investigative strategy. But we have. We likely have interviewed you or someone close to you. We know that this is about power to you. And you want to know what we know. And one day, you will.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer.
Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems. But getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Wasn't that amazing? I'm sure you're listening to this. I'm sure you're watching this. You might even be in this room. It was really reminding everyone that this is a small community. He is here. He is among us. He is, you know him. Don't forget that. Like we are all involved in this investigation, and we need to turn inward again and refocus on this. What do you think was happening there? That was amazing.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. Exactly how you said it, I believe is what occurred. Because my first trip, as I mentioned, to the bridge with Kelsey, flew home to Atlanta, and a couple weeks later, I get a text from Sergeant Kim Riley. You should come back. We're having a press conference on April 22nd. 2019, you should be there. It was a Monday. So I thought, oh, they're going to, in my head, I thought, oh, maybe an arrest. Cause I knew that they were inviting a lot of the media. And I said, oh, okay. It was right after Easter. We have to be there. So what I was thinking is, okay, what's going to happen here? It's obviously big, but how many shows? I was thinking logistically. So I'm on the 5 a.m. in the morning to talk about what we could see. So I'm writing down thinking what we could see. So the press conference is about to start. We go in the room. I had done some live shots on various shows. So I'm sitting in the front row on the rug, sitting there with my notes. And then he comes out. I did mention going back when we walked in, I had to go back and forth a few times for live shots and then back in the room before the press conference started, back and forth. And these nice volunteers, nice women, kept asking me, did you sign in? Did you sign in? So it was clear to me that it was their job to make sure everyone was signing in. It was very important to them. In hindsight, you think.
So that there was a record of exactly who was in the room.
I think they thought he was going to be there and that he would sign in. So it was very important for us to sign in. So once I saw the superintendent come out and say, change of direction, we're on to you. We believe you live in Delphi or from Delphi, lived here once or still live here and could be in this room, like you said. And at that time, there's lines of cameras behind me. And of course, reporters next to me. And I even have it on my phone. I hit record at that particular time and have that chunk. But it was, then you hear the cameras. It's like the clicks increase. The paper started to do this. And I started to get texts. You're live. You're live. Because no one, you would see that in a movie and think that's not realistic. That wouldn't happen. No, it happened. And I think I found out after I went back and we did a special. I was live the whole next day. Everyone was asking, was he in the room? So that particular day, right after the press conference, the room cleared out. I was live for 2 hours in there. So I have the two photojournalists kind of situating the live truck and getting everything together. And I'm taking notes, but I noticed nobody's there. I mean, empty now. We do have a picture of Abby and Libby behind me that we kept. It was after the show wrapped, I started to get a little fearful thinking, was he in here? Could he come back if he wasn't? But as I was doing this live show, it was so surreal, just what did happened and what had transpired and kind of the theories. I had had a few guests on the show as well, interviews, to think, was this a Hail Mary? Did they really think he was going to be there? Did they have a suspect in mind? At this time, we didn't know. Was someone parked outside of his house? Is that why it cleared out so fast? Where was everyone? Where were all the officers that were packed in the room with us? They're gone. So right after that, we did a special. I was live the whole next day on every show. Then we fly back, we do a special. Detective Holman calls me that, emails me, "Susan, I watched the special. Give me a call when you can." I thought, okay. "Hi, Detective, it's Susan." And he said, "Well, I watched it. You did a good job, but you mentioned the FBI a lot." And he was kind of a funny guy, a nice guy, just kind of like an older brother type, like always like jabbing at first. When I first did the interview with him, I'll preface this, my first time there, he said, "Well, I don't think I'm going to talk to you. I don't like you." And I said, "Okay, I don't like you either." And then he said, "Okay, I'll do it. I'll do it." So he's kind of that type of guy, funny. So he said, "Well, you mentioned the FBI a lot." I said, "Well, you don't tell us anything. What are we?" And he said, "Well, it was our idea. They didn't even think we should do that." So I got the sense of, okay, there's kind of egos here and they're not as cohesive as people are saying. And a cousin of mine, Kevin Hendricks, is in the FBI. I called him after that and said, "What is the dynamic?" Because you see it in movies and you wonder, is that true? And he said, "Well, if two girls are missing, the FBI is immediately, or anyone, a minor missing, the FBI is called in. They're in no matter what. If their bodies were discovered as they were with Abby and Libby the next day, the FBI is to be invited in." And invited meaning then it's up to state police, local police to say how much access they have. So as far as we know, they could only have, let's say, the tip line to the FBI, but they're blocked off from anything that local and state police don't want them to see. So apparently it was their idea, as he told me, and FBI said, "We don't think you should do it." So that always stuck with me, thinking, why didn't they think they should do it? Was this a Hail Mary to get some movement? Like, let's do this. And of course, I'm speculating here because we still, a lot of these details we won't know until trial. I'm wondering, was it a thought of, okay, we got to do something. We need movement here. Mm-hmm. It's been more than 2 years. And tell, I think, as you mentioned, I think it's, it was also, he's in this town because the it was open to the public and not a lot of press conferences are. Not necessarily, I mean, they're just not. And they gave people enough time to make plans to get there. I wonder if he was really just speaking to the family of the guy in the bridge and saying, we know you live here. We're on to you. We have more witnesses. Time's up. Make the call. I think that in hindsight is really what was being said.
And that's a good point. He lives in the town. The FBI, for all their expertise, always have that broader and it seemed to me more formal perspective, whereas this is a resident. This is a member of the community who is frustrated and he is so much closer to the families. And yeah, it is a small town and it's like they need a shake up. I need to shake you guys up, re-energize you, and everybody needs to get back in the game, you know? And as you say, we won't know until I guess the trial really plays itself out. If it worked, if it had any impression at all on the investigation, if it changed things at all. But I can understand how it felt like it was worth a try.
One thing that is not clear to me at this time, it'll be interesting to hear, is the sketch. So it was so shocking that you may be in this room, but then the sketch that was unveiled, it looked like a teenager, like an 18. I know it's a sketch and not a picture, but it looked like a young sketch, completely different from the first sketch. And it depends on what year it was and who you speak to. But the superintendent, Doug Carter, did say, okay, the first sketch is secondary. Now look at this.
Well, that's interesting because now after the arrest of Richard Allen, in hindsight, that whole press conference looks confused, doesn't it? Because on one hand, it sounds like, oh my God, maybe they know exactly who it is. It sounds like they're really zeroing in. Then they unveil a new sketch that looks nothing like the man they eventually arrested.
Right. Richard Allen looks like the first sketch. So was it, and we can only speculate because we don't know, was it to say, okay, you can let your guard down here. We're no longer looking for you, whoever this first sketch is. This is who we're looking for, but not really. I do know that the sketch of the younger person was actually the first sketch that was drawn in this investigation. It was the first one and then the second one. And law enforcement decided based on the interviews and the witnesses that it was that person. Because there was more than one person down there that day. There were the girls and the probable cause affidavit. So was the younger sketch someone who they had seen prior? I don't know, but I do know that unveiling was deliberate. Was it because they thought the person looked like that younger sketch, or was it to have the person that is the first sketch let down his guard? We don't know. And I think part of the confusion and maybe the secrecy, I believe with good intentions to for the integrity of the investigation, but it became almost too many secrets, too many things that weren't told to the media and to the public. Now, I can say that in hindsight, I'm not criticizing law enforcement, but it became the story, what they weren't telling us instead of what they were. And then they even pulled back a little more because there were names that came up through the years, particular names. And I got close with Sheriff Tobe Lesenby. I texted him and said, hey, what about this guy? He was arrested. And there is whispers that it even looked like there may have been a tattoo of Libby's face on his arm. He was arrested for a horrific crime, kidnapping a nine-year-old in his neighborhood. He called her to the door, brought her in the house. She was found in the basement, assaulted, but alive. And he was arrested for that. Well, of course, this is what authorities said not to do. The sketch was put up next to anyone who was arrested, really in the Indiana vicinity in that area, and saying, could it be him? So I said to Tobe, is he part of the investigation? And he said, we're looking into him like we look into everyone else. They were very particular with what words they chose. And I don't blame him, because every time that someone came out, and the families were concerned because they put up the bridge guy and they put up a person who was arrested for having nothing to do with Abby and Libby. And their worry was, what if people watch that, the sound's down, and they think the guy's in custody and they don't have to look anymore? So the family was really holding on to hope through the media, through maybe someone watching out there and saying, oh my gosh, it could be this guy. So they wanted the investigation to go as smooth as possible. Of course, everyone did. Well, the headlines started to say, Tobe was open in the beginning with the media saying, yes, we're looking into him. Well, then that was the headline. Sheriff Lesenby says they're looking into this guy for the murders. And he said, well, he never really said suspect. They never said, we suspect this person, ever. So when Richard Allen was arrested, to me, that really filled in the blanks for me of these other people who through the years had come up as part of their normal investigation, even Ron Logan, the guy I mentioned off the top who I interviewed. It was his property. It turns out when the probable cause affidavit was leaked and he was handing it out, he was talkative. He was talking about how he was wrongly investigated. But turns out an FBI agent did get a warrant and his property was searched. But if you read that probable cause affidavit, you think, wow, they believe it might be him. But that was early on. Of course, you look to the people closest, his property. The investigators are going to look at him, but he was never arrested for that. Now, he was arrested for violating probation, and he was sentenced to jail time. And he said to the judge before he walked off to the jail, he said, I guess you shouldn't have people murdered on your property, meaning that he was targeted for that. And that first trip to the bridge that I took that I mentioned earlier, it was my second visit to the bridge. I was walking back and I see him come out of his house and he said, police ruined my life. And it was Ron Logan. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, they put me away for probation because it was drinking and driving and probation violation. And he said, and people came in my house and they stole my furniture. I mean, he looked and sounded completely different, of course, than from that next day after the murders. But I think if they had enough evidence, someone else would have been arrested throughout the years, because there are, and you don't have to look far, so many conspiracy theories surrounding this.
So tell us about Richard Allen. It seemed to come out of the blue, certainly from this distance. Mm-hmm. Did it for you? Did that arrest come out of the blue? This is, as we've mentioned, for all intents and purposes, a mild-mannered pharmacist, or certainly he works at the local pharmacy, chemist we call them. He's worked there for many years in town. There are photographs of him sitting at a bar with his friends with the sketch pinned to the notice board in the background of the perpetrator they're looking for. Who is this man, or who did people think he was prior to the arrest?
Isn't that common that we all think of, I'm sure you do, you don't think of a monster or someone capable of a double murder as looking. I picture them looking evil,
Yeah.
You think they're going to look like a monster, and they rarely do. That's what's so frightening. They rarely do. What's so fascinating to me, or to everyone really, how could they live their normal life? How could they go on it? How can they? Well, according to Paul Holes, and we all know this, they're not like us. So they can do that, the psychopath, and if it is Richard Allen, he was able to stay married. He was able to raise a daughter. She's married, walked her down the aisle. All of the things that you think, that can't be true. A man who's married, right, at CVS. And chillingly, so the day that this arrest happened, because I had heard names throughout, as I mentioned, and one year I was in Florida, I think it was like 4 years in, and I get a call from a producer, but I was off and I was away. But I would have done something on the phone or in a studio in Florida, but she said Inside Edition wants to talk to you, because I had gotten to know them in Delphi. There may be someone connected to the murders. That was the man with the tattoo that people would say looked like Libby. So nothing came of that. So there were times where I heard names, but never an arrest. And I get a text from a friend of mine and a producer, and he said, arrest Delphi, a father. And he sent it, and I went, oh, holy shit.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at this, I go, oh my God, because obviously it was an arrest. And of course, the connection is there with his wife. People at CNN are taking the wife's Facebook page, you know, pictures you want to see, not putting it on the air, but gathering that. It has since gone away, just to find out everything we could. And still, there were so many secrets, I guess you would call it, or info that we weren't getting as to what led them to Richard Allen on that particular day. But I called Becky, Libby's grandmother, as soon as I heard. So I drove home, waited about an hour and thought, should I? I'm calling her. So I called, no answer. She calls me right back. I said, oh my gosh. She said, hold on. I'm walking out in the hall. I'm at my nephew's wedding.
Oh my
God. And she said, I don't want to ruin the wedding, but I could sense almost like a jittery excitement. Mm. But it's what everyone's talking about. Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. I said, what does Mike say? And she said, well, he's still hesitant. We didn't get the call yet from the investigators. So he wants the official, like this is, Mike was hesitant because his hopes were up in the past, but they knew, of course, when someone's in custody, this is serious. And I said, do you know who he is? And she said, oh my gosh, Tara, her daughter, which is Libby's aunt, who I'd met several times. She said, Tara remembers him. She went into CVS the day of the funeral. She was getting pictures developed to put near the casket of Libby blown
up. That story's true. I was going to ask if that's true. Oh my God.
It's true. She was crying and he said, it's on me. Like here, I know I go to FedEx a lot to send stuff to my parents or my sister. So I know the FedEx people. Don't you like, or CVS, don't you kind of have familiar faces?
Absolutely. Yeah.
But that was it. So he said, it's on me. And to think that he would be able to say that.
That he handed over these photos of the victims and said, it's on me. That's unbelievable.
It's unbelievable. So it was so shocking.
And you're so right. That point about, you know, how we always say, how could they do that? How could a person do that? Because of course we don't understand. And it's a good thing that we don't understand. We don't think that way.
Yeah, we don't think that way. And I think that tends to be the fascination in someone like Bundy that we've seen over and over and over again, or Dahmer, or these people that it's like, wait a minute. But what I think is also, I guess, hard to comprehend, shocking, is that someone could have that double life, that family life.
Yes.
We didn't see that with Jeffrey Dahmer. We saw that with BTK.
Yes.
He terrorized a Kansas community for decades, a serial killer who called himself BTK. For bind, torture, kill. Because that's exactly what he did to his victims. His spree lasted from 1974 to 1991, during which time he claimed 10 lives, including 2 children.
I got to know BTK's daughter through the years, and she had no idea.
I was just thinking of her, absolutely, because she's written books and stuff about it, hasn't she?
Yeah, she's a wonderful person. She said, I had zero idea. She said, now that she's in therapy, she has PTSD, she felt like, should I have known? I should have known. She didn't know. He would say, don't forget to fill up your tires, and make her scrambled eggs, and walked her down the aisle. And the human brain, I think, with anyone's family, who you love, who you think you know, can conceptualize or maybe even go there. And now that I'm saying this out loud, I wonder if that was the problem with the tip line. We can't, as quote unquote, healthy, normal human beings who aren't sociopathic killers, can think that someone I'm living with is capable of that.
Absolutely. I think no matter how many times you see that video, guys down the hill, you hear the voice, I don't think we could cope with thinking that's my father, that's my husband. So where are we at now with Richard Allen's? The trial has begun.
No, it hasn't begun. So it was supposed to start in January, and it's very convoluted. And the defense attorneys, there's a gag order in this case. So I am in contact with the families, but I don't talk about the case at all. With Becky, I'll say, how's Kelsey? Kelsey had a baby girl, so she'll text me pictures. But it's not, of course, it's a gag order, and I don't want to say, you know, and nothing has started yet in terms of the trial. But the gag order is in place, so it's not tried in the media. Meaning, so the defense attorneys came out and they wrote a letter. He was appointed to attorneys, and it said, they called him, his name is Richard Allen, they called him Rick. Rick didn't do this. You know, a gag order was implemented. Judge Frangal then said, okay, this gag order is in place throughout until the start of the trial. Well, then the defense attorneys came out with what is called a Frank's motion, because they said that the authorities didn't have a right to search Richard Allen's property. So that was, they wanted to write that in a motion and give it to the court, which is completely within their rights. Within that Frank's motion was 136 pages. And if you read it, you won't be the same person on the other side, of just bizarre, I think irresponsible theories that it's Odinous. And again, innocent until proven guilty, and the families, everybody, who wouldn't? No one wants an innocent man put away for something he didn't do. No one wants that, because then the real guy's still out there. Richard Allen, during a hearing in June, confessed to his wife. It was discussed at this hearing, June 2023, that he, in prison, was on a call with his wife and mother and confessed several times that he had done it, confessed to the murders. Not only, it was mentioned at this hearing, there weren't cameras in the courtroom, and both the prosecution and the defense attorneys all said, yes, that did happen. Well, soon after that, it was Richard Allen shouldn't be in there. And I think that's a fair argument to have. Before you're convicted, you're not usually in the type of prison he's in. He should really be in a jail. So that's a fair argument to have, absolutely. But all of a sudden it went from he's deteriorating. He's been treated like a war criminal. He's eating paper. And there was a picture of him where he did look thin and
he's lost a lot of weight. Yeah.
Yeah. But wouldn't anyone, could yeah. all of us do that in prison? I'm sure it's not a place that you want to be. But right, innocent until proven guilty. So my personal opinion, I don't think he should have been there. I think they should have transferred him out of that particular prison. But then fast forward. So everyone was focused on the confessions, that both sides said, yes, he did confess to his wife and mother. And you know, it's on a recording. And the wife hung up abruptly is what we heard. And fast forward to this Odinous theory and this 136-page memorandum, what the defense attorneys did, they named names, too, of people who had been looked at or maybe investigated. They named names, and they said that it was Odinism. And guess what? We talked about all of it. And guess what was not discussed? The confession. It worked. I feel like it worked, because no longer were we talking about a confession. It was being tried in the media. And I was right there, too.
And it's also raising reasonable doubt, right?
Oh, my
gosh. It's also planting an idea that, yes. Well, hey, yeah, hold on a second. Maybe there's something else involved. Because if this guy's losing his mind and eating paper, is he capable of this really complex crime scene? Odinism, I've just Googled because I couldn't get my head around.
I didn't know what it was either.
No, mm-hmm. An ancient Nordic religion. I do know that it was, and the idea was that the bodies had been staged sort of along the lines of runic. What's the word?
Yeah. And it depends who you ask. Could it have been sticks that were thrown? Could it have been staged? And they said that Richard Allen, they were alluding to this, but in that memorandum, or what you want to call it, 136 pages, there was a footnote at the bottom, because it said in there, those working in the prison had Odinism patches. And that turns out to be true. There was an Odinism patch. Now, they were alluding to the fact that he felt threatened, so he had to make this confession. But then at the bottom, it said a footnote that actually didn't really happen. So it was all of this stuff. It felt like thrown against the wall, even if it had once been investigated. It was just all thrown out there after years of nothing being released. And then all of a sudden, all of this, the snowball of conspiracy theories is just out there.
And it's so sensational. And it's such a perfect time in the history of mankind to throw out a conspiracy theory like Odinism. Isn't it?
And my question would be, because guess what's also lost in all of this? The families, they Absolutely. Want this solved like anyone does. If it's not Richard Allen, the families don't want him wrongly convicted. Why would they? Then the guy who did it is still out there. And if it's an Odinism group, you know, can you really convince other people in this cult to kill two girls? Is it all of these people? And none of them came forward. Usually it's one, because the more you that are involved, as we've seen through history, it's usually one person, the serial killer. You work alone. This many people knew about this and no one came forward. It just seemed ridiculous. And I feel like it was a slap in the face to the families. So where we are now is that there was a hearing that was scheduled and Judge Gold was there. And it was the first time that she allowed cameras in the courtroom for this hearing. Some people say it was there for a reason. Also, after this Frank's hearing, disguised as, I think, a violation of the gag order, it was known that the crime scene photos of Abby and Libby had been leaked. Someone had contacted me too, to see if I wanted to see them. I didn't. They were leaked. And one of the attorneys, it was Baldwin. So it's Baldwin and Rosie. It was Baldwin's, someone who he used to work with, that found the photos, took a screenshot of it, therefore it's released. Well, Judge Fran Gull was not happy about that. There was a meeting in chambers with Rosie, the prosecutor, Nick McClelland, and Baldwin, and Judge Gull. There was a meeting.
Those photos found their way onto YouTube and onto social media, didn't they?
Yeah. So then they come out. Judge Gull comes out and says, turn of events, they've taken themselves off the case. And there is no hearing. So now the attorney said, apparently, like, I will take myself out. The other one said, I'll put it in writing. One of them put it in writing. The other one said they're going to do the same. Fast forward, they come forward and say, we're not off the case. We want Gull kicked off the case. So it's at the Indiana Supreme Court. They want the judge gone. And the judge, should she have? Now, what was discussed in chambers has since been released. And she's essentially saying, and I'm paraphrasing, gentlemen, I don't feel comfortable with you continuing on in this case. Meaning, we can go out there and we can have a hearing, but I'm going to mention what has happened here. The leaked photos, the irresponsibility. Would she have sanctioned them, which is a fine, which can happen? And there were cameras in the courtroom at that time. And Baldwin was saying, if that's my only choice, again, paraphrasing, I have a family. I don't want to be embarrassed in front of everyone. I'll just be off the case. And then the hearing was canceled. The next day, they say, we're not off the case. We're on the case. We want Judge Gull out. So that's where we are. But when she did come out and say, turn of events, that these gentlemen are now off the case, they wanted to pull out of the case. Now they're saying they never wanted that and that Richard Allen wants them in. She did say, we can't have a trial in January when he doesn't even have attorneys. Soon after that, two new attorneys were appointed. There was another hearing. All four attorneys show up. The two that said they were no longer on it, the other two. It's a mess.
It is a mess. And meanwhile, as you say, there are the families. There are the families. So October of next year?
Yeah, that's when Judge Gull at that particular meeting said that it's been postponed till October of next year. But we don't know right now. A decision hasn't been made. I'm expecting it to be made soon in terms of Judge Gull's response. If she's still on the case, if the two new appointed attorneys remain on the case, and I don't see the attorneys that were once being reappointed, but they did say, look, we'll do it pro bono. We'll do it for free. So what are his rights in terms of hiring his own counsel for free? So it'll be interesting, but we've talked about really everything from the time that confession occurred till after. It's been a real mess. And I do feel for the families having to hear all of this when it hasn't even gone to court.
Is Indiana a death sentence state?
It is.
Wow. Okay.
So that, and that's a great question. And it's something to ask in terms of, will there be a plea bargain here at all involved, or will it go to trial?
It seems to drag things out though. And reasonably so. I mean, it's a very serious possibility. So it does seem to extend the legal process.
Exactly.
From my observation. But yeah, the families always are the losers in every way, it seems. And in October just gone, you posted on X, formerly known as Twitter, a really powerful photograph from Patty. Who's Patty?
Oh, yeah, that's Becky Patty. So that's Becky. Right. That's Libby's grandmother, who I'm closest to. The one I called when someone was in custody. Like, yeah. Oh, my gosh. So that's.
And the post was about her comment was, this is how we spend vacation with our loved ones. How do you spend yours? And there's a photograph of Libby printed on a blanket that they've sort of gently spread over the back of a couch. It's a beautiful photo of Libby smiling, just looking like a beautiful, innocent teenager.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because that was their biggest fear too. Of course, this from happening again, but with the girls, they're every day. They miss the laughter of Libby coming in the kitchen. They miss her every single day. So as we're arguing over Odinist theories, they're missing Abby. They're missing Libby. They don't have the girls there anymore. It's a gaping hole in their heart. And their fear was that the girls would be forgotten. And she said she makes it a point, Libby's family, they think, the first year, she wanted to go to Chicago for spring break. The first year after she was killed, they all went to Chicago. They brought her picture. They went to the restaurants, what she would like. I remember a year after, Libby said to me, Libby's grandmother said, you know, Libby would have wanted me to ride the scooter. She'd always say, come on, grandma, come on, do this, do that. And so she did it. And we were on a panel and the crowd laughed. And she just said, I feel like she's with us, not physically, but with us. So with that, they bring a picture of Libby on a beach, whether it's a blanket or a sheet, they always bring her with, if you will. But she said, it's the little thing, Susan, like your dental insurance card comes, but Libby's name isn't on there. Everyone else's is. She said, it's the little things that are just heart wrenching. But that post, the reason I reposted it, I could feel her anger. It was after all this crazy stuff. Oh my God. It's just, I felt for her. Sorry.
Yeah. No, it's okay. I did too. Yeah, it's funny. It's an unexpected, I've never seen anyone do that before. I've seen a lot of people mark occasions, mark holidays, or bring their lost loved ones with them in different ways. But this beautiful fluffy blanket with the photograph printed on it, so that she's on the couch. That's what really touched me. I thought, that's so beautiful. So that when everyone's relaxing together in the living room, Libby's there.
She's there. And they never are without thoughts of Libby, ever. Even with Kelsey, she had a baby girl this summer. She did say to me in Austin, Texas, we were together on a panel and we were at dinner after. And it was a group of us. And I heard her, I said, oh, when are you getting married? You're engaged. And she said, it's coming up and I'm so excited in this. And she said, but, you know, I'm not going to have kids until a person's caught or arrested. I can't do it. I have to be there for Libby. Almost like she was reiterating what she had decided years ago, you know, maybe before she even met her husband, fiance at the time. And I wanted to say, but I didn't, because I thought, who am I to say anything like this? I wanted to say, no, you should. And I just didn't. And then fast forward, I remember when Kelsey's grandmother said to me, Kelsey's pregnant. Someone was in custody. I think she felt... because there's a guilt, they say, that they feel that they connect with other victims in terms of family members of, we can go on with our lives and we can laugh and, you know, I'm getting married, the milestones, graduation, marriage, kids, Libby should be here. She's not. Why isn't she here? They wonder, it dampens everything. But they know, and Kelsey said this, that Libby would want her to live on and be happy, because then he wins.
It's strange. It must be strange for you. I mean, you must feel as though you know Libby.
I felt that way when I saw video of Libby, because we all see, and I mentioned this, and it's so true, and the many stories that I've covered, we see that the still shot, I remember with Scott Peterson and Lacey Peterson, you see Lacey Peterson still shot. You see a picture or two. Now with social media, it's a little different. But with Libby, just seeing the videos that Kelsey showed me and her laughter and really going through, as I was writing the book, I was on Facebook and I'm looking at her Facebook page that is now turned into a memorial page. But going way back to the beginning, I mean, she was on Facebook a lot. And the jokes she would play on Tara, I saw their relationship in a new light, how close they were, more like best buds than aunt and niece, and they played jokes on each other. Like Libby would get on her page and say, "My favorite niece is Libby, hands down." So they would joke with each other. And some of the messages she said, like, be your strongest on your darkest days. Videos that she would post. There was a video of Abby who said, "Thanks so much." She was showing her different friends in a quick like montage of pictures. And she said, "Thanks for making this year one of my best." So you just saw the regular Libby, like the, and you saw her and she almost came to life in her posts. And you saw, okay, this is just a regular kid who's funny, who's sweet, who left sticky notes around the house. And you open a door, pull down your visor and say, "I love you." And she was just, she always thought of others first, always. And Mike said early on, you know, at the press conference when he stood up, he said, because someone was asking about the video with Libby, and he said, "You know what? I think both girls are heroes." He said, "We don't know exactly what happened down there that day, but I believe that one of them could have possibly made a run for it, and they didn't. They stuck together." He said, "They're both heroes." And I do want to end on this note, which I think it's a bright light in all of this. I do remember asking Superintendent Doug Carter when someone was arrested. I remember him saying, because his father was in law enforcement, that I said, "Good outweighs evil. You had said that to me years ago. Do you still believe that?" And he said, "Susan, I do. I promised my father I wouldn't become bitter like he became because of being in law enforcement, everything they say." He said, "And I'm proud of that because I'm not bitter. I believe that good outweighs evil," which I believe. And the families, their focus has been on, I think throughout, it helped them at least throughout the process, the Abby and Libby Memorial Park. And it's Abby and Libby Memorial Park that you can log on to and go see. And there's pavers that you can buy where you can have messages. And it's just a massive park, which it started out, the families were joking, maybe a softball field for the girls, because they were getting ready to play softball together before their murders. It would have been the first time they played together on a team. Well, they thought, why not a softball field? And then it turned into an amphitheater. It's just massive. And their pictures are there. You see Abby and Libby, and that's what the family says, healing for them. Hearing the laughter, they have charity events, walks, bike rides. So it's a place where they have some sort of solace, where it is peaceful and they can remember the girls and kind of escape from all the noise. I just think it just brings the heart of the girls, who they were, not just what happened to them on that day, because that's of course going to be the focus during the trial, but it's who they were before, just wonderful girls, and the emptiness that they left is being able to, though, fill it with happiness. Because if evil outweighed good, that would be for nothing. The family wants everyone to remember the girls in that way of who they were.
Thank you to our guest, Susan Hendricks, author of Down the Hill. And thank you for supporting Australian True Crime.
If you need support after listening to this podcast, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14 or contact 1-800-RESPECT on 1-800-737 732 or 1-800-RESPECT.org.au. Indigenous Australians can contact 13 Yarn on 13 92 76 or 13yarn.org.au. Thank you for downloading this episode of Australian True Crime. We'll be back next week.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Ever Googled your own name? Prepare for a shock because your personal info, including addresses and phone numbers, is out there, especially with the recent hacks at some big phone and healthcare companies. But here's where Aura steps in. Aura scans the dark web for your sensitive information and sends real-time alerts. Aura also actively requests that your information be removed from data broker sites, putting you back in control. Aura provides you with a complete online safety toolkit, credit and transaction monitoring, a secure password manager, a privacy-enhancing VPN, and more. Try Aura risk-free with a 14-day trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety. Rest easy with Aura. Visit aura.com/safety today.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
As promised, I am thrilled to announce that our tickets for Australian True Crime Live are now available. Join me in Sydney, Brisbane, and or Melbourne this July. You can come to all three if you want. These tickets are expected to go very quickly, so be sure to secure yours by visiting the link in our podcast bio, or you can head over to the Australian True Crime Facebook page. There'll be a nice link there for you.
Update for Brisbane Australian True Crime fans. Brisbane is almost fully sold out for our live show.
If you've been a listener for any length of time, you'll know how passionate I am about true crime stories from Australia. I'm looking very forward to an incredible evening together with you, sharing these captivating tales. We will have great guests as well. So, you know, we love a Q&A. If you've ever come along to an Australian true crime live gig, you'll know we love a Q&A with our guests. Don't miss out. Book your tickets today, and I'll see you in July for a memorable night out.